I'm Ruthie.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome to Our Married Life, where we share conversations about our study of the Urantia Book and how to best live its teachings.
Well, we're so glad to have you here with us once again. This is a little bit of a different setup for us, isn't it, Ruthie? We're not in the same physical space this time, but we're blessed.
Not even the same time zone.
No, we're not. Technology is allowing us to solve some of these problems. Where are you at, Ruthie?
Well, I am in Colorado on a rehearsal break with my piano cello duo.
That's right.
So you might hear some piano music coming up from the downstairs.
That's right. And then you might hear all the usual sounds, us sipping our water or tea, or not. We'll just see how it goes. We'll see how this approach goes. So we are continuing our study of the childhood of Jesus. We call it Jesus of Nazareth. This is Jesus the boy. And we're in paper 124, right at the beginning, going through just the first couple of paragraphs of section two. So the real heart of this is section zero, the preface, and section one. And it's a very fascinating study. We've just got ideas brimming with things we could talk about, don't we, Ruthie? What do we want to start with?
Well, the beginning is a very good place to start. section zero. I won't read the full first sentence, but the first half of it. Although Jesus might have enjoyed a better opportunity for schooling at Alexandria than in Galilee, he could not have had such a splendid environment for working out his own life problems with a minimum of educational guidance.
A minimum of educational guidance. So, yeah, primo education in the big city versus a minimum of educational guidance in a little village. What an interesting, provocative thing they offer to us there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, where my mind goes first, honestly, is back to paper 103 in section 5, where we're told, man develops best when the pressures of home, community, church, and state are least.
Yeah.
Which is not to say there's no place in progressive society for home, social institutions, church, and state, but that resonates with me as I think of the decisions that Jesus was having to make with his life and the difference that it feels going through life when you don't have a lot of pressure, either, you know, trying to coerce you to go one way or the other, but also not being too handsy, just sort of stepping back and let a person really go through their own process.
Yeah. Yeah. It was reminding me of the, because what is a minimum of educational guidance mean? I think that that could easily be misinterpreted. People could read that and say, okay, no educational guidance. No, it says a minimum of. So it reminds me of a quote that's not properly attributed to Einstein, where he says things should be as simple as possible, but no simpler.
Sure.
It's a paraphrasing. Right. So, you know, a minimum of educational guidance, as you've brought up this analogy, you know, there's still, the kid is on the playground, but there is still a perimeter fence. The kid knows that there are boundaries, but then they have a great deal of discretion within those boundaries to be creative and to have these spirit ministries act on them.
Well, and also I think it's, you know, when I think of, let's see, I'm on the spot. I hadn't thought about this before, but let me think. During my cello education, I'll say, which really started when I was 7 in public school. And then, of course, by high school, I had private lessons a bit late for people who pursue it professionally. And then, of course, my college degrees. Mm-hmm. But it definitely, I have had many opportunities in that to sort of be given an objective or a problem to solve, a task, a piece to learn. I have most appreciated the time when I was given the space to really figure this out on my own. Like, where are all the notes on the cello? What fingering works better? Should I use the first finger here, second finger there? And just given the space to explore. However, to me, where that minimum of educational guidance comes in is when I'm just spinning my wheels over and over and over, there comes a point where I need some intervention. I need that revelation once I've exhausted my evolutionary capacities.
that's, I like that pattern that you just invoked there. Yeah, you're bringing up.
I came it up myself.
Yeah, right. You're reminding me of things from my own childhood. I mean, I could think of a couple of examples. They're more in the realm of, I guess, broadly what I'd call my scientific education. So Jesus had a workbench. I had a workbench as a kid, a little spot in the garage that was all mine. My dad just sort of stayed away and did his other stuff over here. I don't feel like I really got much directionality on that. I sort of set up the same experiment, not even an experiment, an apparatus week after week. Oh, let's bubble some more water with electricity. I never had something I was going to. And I'd never had a sense of like, well, where to go from here? And this was way before there was an internet or internet search. So I kind of just stalled out and did the same thing over and over. A lot of that same stuff happened with my programming hobby on the computer as a really young kid. It didn't really go anywhere. And I don't feel that I had a parent who was saying, okay, he's getting stuck. We need to take him to the library and find him a book and tell him no more experiments until you read. You know, I had very little guidance. I think it was too much of a minimum.
Yeah, well, I might say that didn't meet the minimum.
There we go. Yeah, didn't meet the minimum.
And as a music teacher, I can liken this to giving children free time on an instrument or singing or perhaps any artistic pursuit, could be drawing. There's much value, of course, in allowing some space to for them to just explore. But at a certain point, and I should say this not just as a teacher, as a student, at a certain point, I feel I'm not actually going anywhere, you know, and like part of the minimum educational guidance, it may not be that, oh, I'm stuck. I mean, it could be that I want to express something and I'm stuck in terms of knowing how to execute it. But it could also be, maybe I'm executing the ideas just fine, but the ideas are just staying at this sort of low level and they're not being uplifted. They're not continuing to grow. And I don't know, I maybe this is sort of my tentative framework for defining what is that minimum. At what point does there need to be intervention? And maybe it really is when the evolutionary capacity has exhausted itself. That's when parents and teachers come in, either to help someone get unstuck or to uplift and make sure they keep growing.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting framework that you're developing here. It matches my workbench example, my programming example. I remember sitting there at the computer feeling hungry, like, yeah, I was stuck, but there's no internet. I had no way to search to figure out what the next thing is. I didn't get unstuck until I finally took a formal programming class in 10th grade in high school. And then I'll quickly, because since you brought up music, I did take private flute lessons when I was in high school. This was the opposite. I got too much instruction. Yeah. I had a teacher who would do the interpretations of my solo pieces for me. She would do it for me. I got used to that. I just show up and she would always put the breath marks and suggest crescendos and decrescendos. We did that for 2 years, not 2 weeks or not 2 months, but 2 years. I didn't explore, I didn't even know that I could be interpreting on my own. So too much guidance.
To me, from the perspective of a parent or a teacher, any sort of mentoring figure, the person with the most experience or most advanced on a topic is the one who knows the trajectory pattern. That's pretty abstract, but you know, basically, I think of it as a tour guide. You know, a tour guide knows where the path is. Now, the tour guide can't force someone else to walk. They're not going to literally pick up the person's feet and move left, right. Like the person who's being guided needs to do the work for themselves. So I think that's the thing. It's being a tour guide and showing them where the path is. That's where the guidance is. Because if a tour guide's not showing the path, you might fall off a cliff. Well, or you might just never get to your destination because you're walking in circles.
This is fascinating, the connection I just made here. You reminded me that long ago I was taught how to be a tour guide as a seasonal park ranger. And one of the things that they said, one of the principles of interpretation they said when you're a tour guide in the parks is interpretation is not information, but revelation. They actually use the word revelation. So it's like you're trying to take these people to where they can figure some things out on their own. It's just fascinating that that word was used independently in a secular how-to guide on how to lead people through parks. But it's the same idea, minimum of educational guidance so that they can grow into the park and connect with it, or grow into the music and connect with it. It's a, it's a pattern.
So that minimum, I think it's enough that you can help support their walking the straight and narrow path, basically. There is, you know, there are boundaries, but then in terms of how they're doing that or how long it takes them to get there or looking along the way, like you just let them sort that out for themselves.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what that makes me think about, sort of to another topic you and I both found interesting, was this fascinating thing where Jesus got basically a quarter of his time as free time, 20% of each month. He didn't have to be in school. And so that certainly sounds like a time for a minimum of educational guidance. But even then, I think that his free time would have looked a lot different than the free time that I relished when I had spring breaks or things here and there.
Yeah, he wasn't playing video games, no Skyrim or Sims or anything. Yeah, I mean, he was visiting the farm, fishing trips with his uncle. Well, I don't think that was part of the monthly things, but yeah, I mean, these seem like such enriching, I mean, learning skills, I mean, very practical, you know, life skills, but also, you know, I think that's probably where he's getting his scientific inclinations nourished. And
yeah, it's you know, something we talked about on the Tuesday Symmetry of Soul show was just how much scientific education in the abstract, that's what we'd call it. They didn't have science classes back then, but all of his engagements with nature are giving him a scientific education. How much, not only how much did he get, but how much do the revelators feel the need to disclose to us? It's almost like they're really beating us over the head with, yes, the incarnated creator son of your local universe was not just a mystic or even just a religionist. He also had a scientific mind. He had both sides of this. This you know, and the super additive of those two put together is philosophy. Right. And he was starting to become wise.
Well, and even, I mean, that also goes along with in this paper, quote, Jesus continued to grow physically, intellectually, socially, and spiritually. And it seems that this comes in a bit, like he was growing in a balanced way.
Yeah. It's something I think you and I are going to think a lot about as prospective parents, about how do we help shape the free time, you know? I mean, maybe Jesus's 25% time away from school wasn't even framed as it's free time to do what you want. It's spring break every month. I doubt it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was more like time to go, you know, learn out on the sea or out at the farm or whatever it was. It was an ongoing education. I think that's maybe why the teachers felt it was okay for him to not be in school, because he could get his education elsewhere.
Very different time. I wish that were sort of how things were now, to be quite honest. I mean, now it sort of doesn't matter how advanced you are. You shall stay in school from 9 to 3 or whatever the hours.
Yeah. Hopefully still with some time for recess in there, because play is still important. I mean, sitting at a desk all day is cruel and unusual. It's cruel. It's not unusual. It's just cruel for a 7-year-old.
Well, I don't know that I have a whole lot to say about this, but I did want to just point out, just read this little passage. I think it's from section 2, actually. But so speaking of Jesus, when on his first trip with his father to observe the fishing industry on the Lake of Galilee, Jesus had just about made up his mind to become a fisherman. But close association with his father's vocation later on influenced him to become a carpenter. While still later, a combination of influences led him to the final choice of becoming a religious teacher of a new order. Yet back in paper 123, that, you know, there's all this written about how he and Jacob, I don't know, what were they, 7 years old or 8 or so? And I just see these little boys at the potter's wheel that they're learning about. And, you know, they many times, both of them determined to be potters when they grew up. So it's just like, well, okay, it sounds like we're in good company. That sounds like me and other kids growing up today. I'm going to be this when I grow. No, now I'm going to be that. And, you know, how many times did that change before?
It usually changes. I do know one person who wanted to be a fireman since he was 7 and he became a fireman, but it's comparatively rare. I know. But yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, that the incarnated creator son of our local universe didn't, I mean, he was still able to be a kid, fully human, and kids want to try out lots of different things. Some of that even extends into adulthood in the Western world for us. You go to college, a lot of people change majors a couple of times, or you got to try on one career and then move around. That seems like that's okay. They didn't try to channelize him immediately when he was 7 or 8.
No, but I will add, though, because I think that can be difficult to wait all the way until college to sort of explore, you know, that's quite an investment to not be sure. I mean, I know that certainly happens and that's okay. But I will say, to me, this you know, what we're reading about Jesus and all this experience he got in all these different occupations, I think maybe we've lost a little bit of that. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not sure kids and adolescents get quite the same. I mean, there are certainly entry-level jobs. I mean, I was an office assistant and a server hostess at some point, but you know, those are pretty entry-level things. Those aren't necessarily like, okay, let me see actually what it's like to be a musician, like apprenticeship types of situations, or I don't know. I think it would be nice if there were more experiences like this for kids growing up.
Well, there, yeah, something to think about with our own kids. What sort of opportunities are there to mm-hmm. explore to these things? Right. I don't think I ever wanted to be a car mechanic, but my dad certainly let mm-hmm. me participate with him fixing the cars in the driveway a lot. And mm-hmm. that was effectively, I was very adept by my 20s. I rebuilt a car engine, as the leader of the group doing it. So I was effectively an apprentice to my dad growing up. That served mm-hmm. me well.
Well, there's one other topic that I felt was particularly interesting, and this touches both sections 1 and 2. Of course, we alluded to this in a past episode already, where Jesus is caught making charcoal drawings in school and, you know, kind of tattled on anyway. so this culminates in a meeting of the elders with Jesus's parents. You know, I think there's some finger wagging going on. Now, Joseph,
you're responsible for this kid. He's not responsible for himself. So Joseph.
And meanwhile, Jesus is listening outside to every word, and I think it was at the moment when they were very explicitly pointing the finger at Joseph that, you know, Jesus resented them placing responsibility on him. He just burst through the doors.
Marched in.
Was that it? Okay. And so what I'm trying to juxtapose is the how Jesus is characterized in this moment, that he frequently, I think, dared to challenge the Shazan. In this instance, courageously defended his viewpoint and made it clear he would also accept his father's ruling on the issue. So courageously defending his viewpoint, he's fearless, it seems.
Yeah.
But is once again, agreeing to play by the rules and the hierarchy and all of this. But then, you know, juxtaposing that with later, where it's made very clear that Jesus, perhaps his most unusual and outstanding trait was his unwillingness to fight for his rights. So he's willing to courageously defend his viewpoint, but disinclined to defend himself even from injustice or personal abuse.
One way I've thought through this is, what a strange thing. Let's fast forward to near the end of Jesus's mortal life. Mm-hmm. And so he's on trial and he's being physically abused and it's a gross injustice. And he stays silent through the whole thing, doesn't say a word, except when someone like Pontius Pilate asks something related to his bestowal mission or about God the Father, like asks or criticizes something specifically of a overtly religious nature. He's silent on all social matters and political matters, but he defends it when it comes to his father or his mission. And I wonder, we don't know exactly what he overheard the elders saying, but I wonder if they were questioning, you know, the viewpoint of what God wants in this case. And maybe he wouldn't, even at that early age, hesitate to defend that. But all these other matters, social matters and his own body and all, he's like, 6 1/2 dozen of the other. Jacob will take care of it.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to study that. I know I presented this as a sort of event that I'm juxtaposing, but I got the sense when it mentions that Jesus, you know, that he was frequently challenging. And I think later, I can't recall if it's in this paper or in a later paper, the elders are, you know, concerned with, despite Jesus's nonconformist tendencies, they did love him.
Right. Right.
Like he just generally, you know, he's a nonconformist. And yet he seems to fully respect actual power hierarchies
that are in place, the customs.
When he actually bumps up against the customs. And again, in Galilee, it's a more liberal in a lowercase L sense of the word. Like there's just more freedom to do things, to go for a jaunt on the Sabbath, for example. He is given a lot more room, but there are still some hard boundaries, you know, clearly happened here. And yeah. And then you've got to figure out, well, what do we do in the face of that? And that's where you get this little thing between Joseph and Mary, his parents. They had different takes on this stuff.
Right.
Yeah. We in the first episode, we really emphasized their teamwork. And that's not saying that this is now an exception to that, but it is a different result. You know, earlier in the paper 123, there are times where, well, Joseph, you know, they had different views on something, but Joseph was able to convince Mary of something, or then Mary was able to, well, maybe not convince Joseph, but, you know, sort of have her own way anyway. And, but it seemed like they were always able to come to some agreement or concession, but here it doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like that really happened here. I think Mary really wanted Jesus to be allowed to continue to model clay at home, just not at school, you know, or charcoal drawings, all of this. And Joseph said, nope, you know, the rabbi's interpretation needs to hold. And so that was the ruling.
Well, what we talked about on the Tuesday Symmetry of Soul broadcast was the Eastern versus the Western views of things. So they say somewhere else that Joseph hewed more toward the Eastern or Babylonian view of the world, which was a more like, well, no, these are the rules and this is God's rules and there's one way to do it.
Right.
Mary was of the more Western or Hellenic model, which is just more free. Like, well, there's lots of stuff in the world and maybe we should just try things out. And who's to say? And it's fascinating that the two of them were able to counterbalance each other. You didn't have two thinkers who were identical. They had some polarity there. And but sometimes, you know, still they just didn't agree.
That's interesting. Well, and you're mentioning that as it translates to today, it's sort of this East-West thing. And I, from my life experience, I had another way of classifying that I think would be a little more collectivistic versus individualistic, perhaps.
Yeah. And just one other thought on it. It's interesting. Mary, and in spite of all this, Mary was the, quote, strict disciplinarian. But here's Joseph ruling.
Right.
Joseph ruled. So the two of them very much, I still do think there's teamwork going on here, but I think they may have had, as we all do, blind spots. You know, Mary may have had a religious blind spot. She may have been too inclined toward just, oh, do whatever you want. But Joseph may have had some disciplinary, just practical blind spots. And Mary was the one who's like, no, we're not doing that. You know, eat your dinner or whatever the matter was. They were a marvelous balance. It's no accident they were his parents, I guess.
I do have to point out one thing. It's sort of not relevant to our main point here, but as I was, you know, looking at this previous section with Jesus and Jacob learning pottery from Nathan in the last paper.
Yeah.
Nathan is totally leading them on to be modeling competitive, that he's encouraging Jesus and Jacob to competitively model with their clay.
Right.
Frustrating. No wonder the kids were told this was okay. And
of course, they wouldn't know. And you wonder what Nathan's deal was. Maybe he was of a very lower, you know, lowercase L liberal bent. He's like, well, let's see how much we can bend this stuff. Well, I guess I did just want to, you know, tie a bow on this. Like, it says Joseph ruled. And are you okay with that kind of language in a marriage?
Wow, on the spot.
Uh-huh.
I'm just hesitating because honestly, the first thought in my mind was, depends on what it is. Depends on how much it bothers me.
But you know, in paper 33, they talk about the model of marriage on high and this whole like subordination. Right. And it just brings in all these questions that we haven't sorted through yet.
Honestly, what to me feels most important is that I respect the values behind it. I mean, I can still disagree with an interpretation or a proposed execution of those values, but I think I can make peace with whatever, so long as I see that we're on the same page with the same values. If we're not, then I could see myself fighting, but it's about the values.
As it should be. And I think that's a fine place to leave it. Thank you for answering that on the spot, on the record. Well, all right. Well, we hope this was of some help to you in your walk with God, your walk through life, and with your family. And until the next time that we get to sit here with you in our home, we'll see you then, and God bless.
Bye-bye.